Hello, it's me, Jesse. You're listening to a preview of a premium episode of Blocked and Reported. You're going to hear Katie and I talk about NPR. Where is it going? What is it doing? Why are so many weirdos saying weird things on NPR? We're going to discuss this problem. We're going to peg our discussion to this big article in the Free Press. If you want to hear the whole thing, go to blockedreporter.org, where for just $5 a month and up, you get 3 extra episodes, actually 4 this month, including an upcoming one on the Cast Report, every month. Great deal. Hope you enjoyed the preview.
Criticism from within NPR has really stayed inside the building until just last week, when a longtime editor named Uri Berliner published a piece in the Free Press called "I've Been at NPR for 25 Years. Here's How We Lost America's Trust." Jesse, could you sum that up for us?
I can. But first, I should just say I occasionally get emails from people trying to break into journalism. I do think what your story tells us is find the most physically attractive person at the New Yorker or the New York Times, send them an email with photos of them attached and be like, "You are so hot. Can I have a job?" And it'll probably work out, right?
Look, it's cheaper than going to J school.
Definitely. This piece, "I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust." The headline sort of says it all. Berliner basically writes that while NPR has always been a somewhat liberal place, it used to be, or it used to strive to be, fair and open-minded. He argues that that's changed in recent years, and it's led to what looks like a pretty profound exodus of listeners of the more like centrist and conservative persuasion. He included some stats that really seem to bear that out. So he gives a few examples.
And not even centrist and conservative. His stats include liberals. NPR is losing moderate liberals.
Right. Losing basically everyone who isn't.
Yes.
We're not allowed to use the word woke, but whatever word we are allowed to use instead of woke.
We can use the word woke.
It's racist. Joel Anderson will punch me if I use it. Did you ever see that tweet? You remember that tweet?
No.
Oh my God.
No.
All right. People can look that up. So it gives a few examples of areas where coverage has fallen short. He also talks about the effects of the DEI. Are we allowed to say that? DEI?
I think it's IDE now.
IDE?
Yes.
Yeah, he talks about the effects of the DEI industrial complex, which seems to have hit NPR pretty hard. And the whole piece is just sort of him exposing the ways in which he thinks NPR has taken a wrong turn, I guess since what, 2016 or 2020, depending how you look at it. How did I do? Did I sum that up correctly?
Yeah, pretty good. And none of this will be surprising to regular listeners of this show, or I think regular listeners of NPR itself. I don't think the emphasis on identity is quite as bad today as it was in, say, 2019, 2020 through 2023. Like, there was a time when every time I turned on the radio, I could reliably bet that the story was going to have some identity angle. Like, for a while, if they were doing the weather update, they would somehow turn it into a story about racism.
Did we ever talk about the I genuinely can't remember, this independent headline from a couple weeks ago? I'll read it to you. You tell me if we talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't NPR, but it's directly connected. "How climate change is hitting vulnerable Indonesian trans sex workers."
Oh my God. Is that a joke?
That's an actual, it's in the Independent. It's a Reuters correspondent. So maybe it wrote, ran in Reuters.
And what's the answer?
"How climate change is hitting vulnerable Indonesian trans sex workers." The cis sex workers are fine. They're living high on the horse.
They have higher horses. Their ankles aren't getting wet.
This to me is like exactly, it's not NPR, but that's like, that could be an NPR segment. Basically.
Totally. Yeah. It would have been an Onion headline 10 years ago, but now it's an independent headline.
Now the Onion would do a headline about how dumb people are who criticize the NPR
exactly.
story. It's
about how criticizing that is racist. Yeah, and as Berliner notes, NPR really prizes this one sort of diversity, and it is not sort of intellectual diversity or diversity of thought. And I still think there are a few holdouts within the public media ecosystem. On Point from WBUR Boston is great. After the Supreme Court struck down affirmative action, they actually had John McWhorter on for a debate.
Racist?
Well, the woman who he was debating for sure thought that he was racist. They also had Hannah Barnes come on and talk about her book about the Tavistock Gender Clinic in the UK. Hidden Brain, I think, is better than most in terms of avoiding the pitfalls of wokeness, for lack of a better term. But so many shows, including the big flagship NPR shows like All Things Considered and Morning Edition, plus shows from member stations like On the Media, Marketplace, Radiolab, there's this emphasis on identity that just pervades the content. And I think I could live with that if it were more interesting. But at the same time, the journalism has just gotten weaker than it used to be. So you're never going to hear a segment on the media that actually challenges doctrinaire progressive positions. And I personally haven't stopped listening to NPR because I'm a creature of habit and it's been my habit my entire life. But I have stopped trusting it because I no longer assume I'm getting the whole story. I mean, how much do you listen to it, Jesse? Has that been your experience as well?
Somewhat. I don't think I've ever been like a true sicko the way you are. But On the Media is an example of a show I used to listen to religiously. And it has... To say that its quality has suffered would be a massive understatement. Whenever they talk about something I know anything about, obviously youth gender dysphoria is something that's come up a few times, it is just so crazy and off the rails and anti-journalistic that I'm astonished by it.
On the Media would probably have Michael Hobbs on to talk about youth gender medicine before they would have you talk about it. Somebody who's actually done significant research on this.
They so other shows, it's like more of a mixed bag. Like Radiolab can still be good, but one of my subtle low moments came when I was listening to this otherwise really interesting Radiolab show about the placenta. I think it aired in 2021. And Katie, will you actually just read this passage? It's from the show transcript, okay?
Yeah. All right. So before we start, we just want to say a note on the word mother.
You were laughing too much. Read that again.
We just want to say a note on the word mother. Not everyone who gets pregnant or has a baby identifies as a mother, but it's a word a lot of people use when talking about pregnancy, including some of our sources. And so we're just going to be using it in addition to more inclusive language like pregnant person and parent. She's basically saying that we're like apologizing for using the slur mother.
They're like interviewing evolutionary biologists and apologizing for the fact that they're going to use offensive terms like mother. Can I also just say, I know identity language has gotten a little weird. The idea that you can, that you can choose whether to identify as a mother in a birthing context is...
Oh. But some people do, Jesse. We read the Thruple article.
So, like, when I hear that, this is my own pathology, because I obviously think some of the sex and gender stuff has gotten really weird. But when I hear Radiolab apologizing for using a straightforward biological term like mother, even if I'm intrigued or interested in the rest of the podcast, it makes me trust it less, because I'm like, who is this for other than the 0.001% of America who yells at me on Twitter? Nobody else thinks it's bad to use the word mother. It's just not, it's just this very fringe thing that I've noticed pop up even on podcasts I otherwise like, or shows I otherwise like.
Uri sort of answers that question in this piece. We'll get to that shortly. But he does tell us who is dictating the language that they use in stories like this. And so a lot of his piece was just kind of confirmation of things that I've suspected. Like, he says that things really changed after the election of Donald Trump. We've talked a lot about that, about how some media organizations felt like it was now their responsibility to be a part of the resistance. And then after George Floyd was killed, he writes that his murder, quote, changed both the conversation and daily operations at NPR. So the CEO at that time, his name was John Lansing. He was clear in that moment that NPR was not just a part of the problem of white supremacy in America, but it needed to be a part of the solution, which to me is just a fundamentally incorrect way of looking at journalism, because I don't actually think the job of the journalist is to make the world a better place.
Quite the opposite.
Right. If you're a podcaster, especially. Like, if you want to do that, go be an activist or a teacher or a politician or a Twitch streamer. The job of the journalist is to reflect the world as it really is.
I mean, I feel like you're offering a slightly strawman-y version of that. Like, journalists can make the world a better place by exposing bad actors or
yeah, like, if it happens, great, but I don't think that should be the mission of the journalist. That's the mission of the advocate.
You know what thought experiment I've always found interesting, and I guess this is sort of similar to the Comey letter, but imagine the day before the election, a liberal mainstream journalist of the, I don't know, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, comes across information that would totally fuck Biden. Like, and this is a hypothetical, it's a thought exercise, but like, what percentage of journalists would actually be like, voters have a right to know this, even if it leads to Trump getting reelected? Because I'm honestly not 100% sure what I would do in that situation. I think there's a little part of me, like, I'd like to say I would just immediately publish something on it, but like,
yeah.
I think that's an interesting way to get at these, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know. What are you looking for?
I just sort of trailed off there. Anyway, yeah.
What is the sort of hypothetical you think that would kill his chances?
Like if it turned out he was a Barpod listener?
That would do it. Okay, here's a quote I found interesting from Berliner. Race and identity became paramount in nearly every aspect of the workplace. Journalists were required to ask everyone we interviewed their race, gender, and ethnicity, among other questions, and had to enter it into a centralized tracking system.
I had heard that before. It's totally wild, yeah. But I love the
And member stations do this too, by the way. This is not just people who work for the NPR mothership. Like your local station is probably doing this too.
I love the idea of like an enterprising young 23-year-old reporter, you know, reporting in Oakland. And in one of his back pockets, there's a notepad. And the other, there's a set of calipers.
And paper bag.
Paper bag.
So yeah, just imagine for a second that you're a journalist and you have to ask anybody you interview what color they are, what their gender identity is. So let's say you're out interviewing members of a militia or Trump supporters or people lined up outside a methadone clinic or really anyone. Like, how do you think this is going to make both you and your subject feel?
I like the idea of like my Mexican migrant workers. I'm trying to think, how do you say it? Estás agender?
You just ask if they're Latino or Latinx.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't really make, it's just this.
It's fucking embarrassing.
Imposition of these categories on everything.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The idea that you're going to ask a source about these identity characteristics that probably has nothing to do with the story you're working on. And in some cases could even like confuse or anger them or just get them to trust you less. It's just, it's again, it's not really a journalistic policy. It's this weird, I don't know. I sort of think DEI industrial complex is the right word for it. It's not serving journalism. It's serving something else.
Yeah. I talked to one NPR journalist who said, I have to ask these questions. I'm required to. So I'll like shoot them an email afterwards and be like, I'm required to ask this question. You don't have to answer it. And he said that 75% of the time people decline to answer the fucking questions.
I would send like the most, like the subject of my email to them would be like, my idiot bosses are forcing me to send this email. I'm so sorry.
Here's another quote from Berliner. We were given unconscious bias training sessions. A growing DEI staff offered regular meetings imploring us to start talking about race.
Well, don't leave me hanging. Did NPR ever end up talking about race at all?
Right. He continues. Monthly dialogues were offered for women of color and men of color. Non-binary people of color were included too. And what all this gets to is that at NPR, it is assumed that if you increase the number of women or non-binary people of color or whatever, you're increasing diversity. But race and gender identity are not actually good proxies for diversity if all the people you're talking to think the same things and hold the same values. And as Berliner notes, NPR makes almost no attempt to reach people with different values, either as sources or as audience members. It's a non-binary, gender-diverse rainbow of people who all think the same.
It's interesting the way, like, this is not an original point, but this conception of diversity lets you, I'm foreshadowing a little bit here, but it lets you ensure that you're continuing to, your organization is going to continue to be run by and to serve upper and upper middle class people with money, while projecting a veneer of diversity.
Yes. It's fake diversity. It's very surface.
Okay. Not like our podcast, which is real diversity.
Okay. So you mentioned a little while ago, you said something about the term mother.
Sorry. You mean M star star T star E R.
I wonder how they feel about the term motherfucker. Is that bad? Should it be pregnant people fucker? So Uri explains that within NPR, there are all of these affinity groups, specifically for Black people or Jews or Muslims, you know, any these demographic groups. So there's a group called Women Gender Expansive and Trans People Women Gender Expansive and Transgender People in Technology Throughout Public Media. Nice ring.
WGETPTTPM.
Yes. And Uri writes, quote, if, as NPR's internal website suggested, these groups were simply a great way to meet like-minded colleagues and help new employees feel included, it would have been one thing, but the role and standing of affinity groups, including those outside NPR, were more than that. They became a priority for NPR's union, SAG-AFTRA, an item in collective bargaining. The current contract, in a section on DEI, requires NPR management to, quote, keep up to date with current language and style guidance from journalism affinity groups, and to inform employees if language differs from the diktats of those groups. In such a case, the dispute could go before a DEI accountability committee.
DEI Accountability Committee. How weird does that sound?
Yeah. So these affinity groups, which are in fact activist groups, are dictating content guidelines to reporters, which explains why NPR was the first to jump both on and then off the Latinx bandwagon. It explains why shows like Radiolab are using terms like mother anymore. And the thing is, the audience doesn't even like this shit. The staff might like it, but I don't think the audience does. So Mike Pesca, he's also a former NPR employee. He did this great spiel about NPR on the April 3rd episode of his show, The Gist. It's called Public Radio Podcast Pounded, which, yes, does sound like a Chuck Tingle title, but it's really worth listening to. And Mike talked about job cuts at NPR and across the system, and he named a few specific shows that NPR cut last year. One of those was this show, Invisibilia, which I really liked when it first came out. It was initially hosted by veteran reporters Lulu Miller and Alex Spiegel, and they did some really great shows. It was sort of like, it was a lot like Radiolab in some ways. It was very curious, highly produced. Like, they did one show about a call out in the Richmond punk scene. That is something that you would have heard on this show, but better. And then Lulu and Alex left, and they were replaced by younger staffers, and it became all about identity. They were explicit about this new mission, and it became unlistenable. And I want to play you a clip from Mike Schwiel about this. It starts with him explaining how Invisibilia changed, and he's got a great example of that change here.
Then in 2021, they ran a story about trains, about slow trains. The idea was we all exist in such a fast twitch, attention-laden environment. It might be soothing to put on a program where a camera just traces the landscape as seen from the side of a slow-moving train. By the way, that actual show is popular in Norway. So here's a clip of the Invisibilia reporter talking to Eric Schatz, a TV producer who had pitched the idea of the slow-moving train to U.S. executives.
His idea of driving across part of California. Sure, it could be a beautiful meditation on our landscape, kind of like a visual version of Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. But not everybody hears that song or sees America's landscape the same way, right? Here's Fred Turner, the media historian, again.
The idea of driving across the American landscape inside a vehicle and marveling and feeling like it was ours, that's pretty hard in a place where just 150 years ago, European settlers wiped out, you know, several million Native Americans, where slavery occurred. You know, those kinds of things make that celebration of the land very difficult.
This show is not about that. It's not about what's right or wrong with our country. Mm-hmm. It's not the show for that. You go to watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox News if you want to fight about that.
I kept pressing the point.
Oh, my God.
What you film is a political decision. Eric pressed back.
Like, just chill out and watch. Take it in. Calm down. Turn down the temperature. Look at this fucking Zen moment in the middle of nothing.
I said that was, you know, a privileged perspective to take.
Oh, my God.
Invisibilia, like much of NPR, maybe much of progressive America, had gone insane.
Katie, that privileged white man yelling at the young female reporter is absolutely correct. Oh, my God. I love this thing of, like, for some reason. That's it. That's all you get for the preview. Thank you for listening. BlockedReporter.org to hear the rest. And remember, our next premium episode coming out in just a couple days will be about the cast review.